Almost without exception, whenever I'm contacted by a reporter, they want me to weigh in on the best treatments for hot flashes, how to deal with vaginal dryness, and of course, how to avoid or get rid of the dreaded muffin top. You would think that a broken internal furnace, sandpaper sex, and postmenopause waking are the only symptoms that women have when estrogen levels tank. But now that I'm in year three of this podcast, my analytics tell me which topics women are really interested in. And the impact of menopause on muscles is way up there. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause midlife and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Okay, so seriously, I do look at my analytics. I mean, part of it is, and I know this will shock you, I'm slightly competitive. And I need the weekly reassurance that my podcast is doing okay and that the number of downloads I get continue to climb. Because I spend so much time obsessively studying my analytics, I have a pretty good idea of what listeners want to hear about. And the episodes that do the best are the ones that impact on the ability to feel good and function day to day. So I wasn't surprised when my episode on musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause with Dr. Vonda Wright had crazy high numbers. And it told me that women wanted to hear more. And I thought, well, there's no better person to bring on than fitness expert and nutritional coach, Amanda Thebe. Amanda was one of my first guests when I launched this podcast, and we had a great conversation about how to maintain muscle mass and peak physical fitness post-menopause. Amanda's best-selling book, Menopocalypse, is a must-read. It's funny, it's practical, and it's medically accurate. That's right, I said medically accurate, because even though Amanda's not a medical professional, she's done an extraordinary job of staying on top of the scientific literature when it comes to the impact of hormones, exercise, diet, and lifestyle to stay in peak physical shape during the second half of your life. So, Amanda, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back. It's good to see you, Lauren.
It's good to see you. You know, you were literally my fourth guest when I started this podcast. My fourth. I went back and looked. And I think maybe 10 people were listening besides my family. So thank you for like jumping in there when this podcast was really just a baby. And I really appreciate that support. But all right, a lot's happened since then. A lot's happened with you. A lot's happened in the medical literature. But particularly, there's this really newly recognized appreciation that I think you've always known, of course, that hormones have an enormous impact on muscle mass. And until recently, it hasn't been well studied, and people are talking about it a lot more. So what's your take on why there's been such an upswing in interest in specifically muscles and menopause?
So it's really interesting, Lauren, because for all that I've been doing this for, I think it's now 35 years, when I first got my first personal training certification, I knew how important that building and maintaining muscle was, but never really truly appreciated it through menopause. And obviously I went through menopause myself and I wrote the book, and anything, like you said, it was medically accurate. It's because I spoke to medical experts. I didn't make that up myself. But when it came to the physiology of menopause and the strength training adaptations and all of those things, I thought I had a pretty good handle on it, but I went digging in the research and there isn't a ton, surprisingly. There isn't a ton.
Not surprisingly, actually.
And so I started following the work of Dr. Stacey Sims, who was looking at adaptations of the female body. And she wasn't really looking at menopause at the time, but she was talking about hormonal influences. One of the things I realized that Stacey was doing, though, was looking at elite athletes, and it wasn't really translating for me down to general population or like weekend warriors like me. Like, it was more that these were elite performance athletes. But I knew from my own personal experience that something was shifting. You know, I've always been strong and not particularly muscular, but, you know, in a pretty decent strength shape. And something was shifting, something was changing. And so just from anecdotally my own sort of experience and then following Stacey's work and then digging down into the research a bit more, we realized that there are shifts that happen through it being, through getting older, just from living, through aging, through being sedentary, and then somewhat accelerated through menopause via the mechanism of muscle protein synthesis, and how our priorities sort of need to shift a little bit as we go into the idea that we're going through menopause.
Okay, so if you think about those three factors, aging, being sedentary, and menopause, I mean, we've known for a long time that aging and being sedentary aren't good for muscles. But this whole concept that there's hormone receptors on muscles and that those estrogen and testosterone receptors are responsible for making new muscle is kind of a new concept. And once you understand that, it makes sense that a drop in estrogen and testosterone is going to accelerate muscle wasting. Not to mention, you kind of need hormone receptors to respond to exercise and strength training, right?
Yeah, estrogen is intrinsically involved in muscle protein synthesis. And so to break that down a little bit, muscle protein synthesis is using the stimulus from protein, which is broken down into amino acids. I mean, I'm preaching to the choir with Lauren here, but for anyone listening,
I think would like to know this because it's not something that I've actually talked about.
And it's super, I find it super interesting. So essentially when you eat protein, it gets broken down in the body to amino acids, and amino acids are like the building blocks for restoring, repairing, replenishing. And they're really important in almost every system in our body because we're all a big fat protein, aren't we? Right. So that's how the human body. We then, when we do strength training or anything that puts an extra load or burden on the muscles and the bone, we use a process called muscle protein synthesis, which takes the stimulus from the exercise, uses amino acids to then hold on to as much muscle as we possibly can and even build muscle if we're working hard enough and eating enough protein. And estrogen is intrinsic within that process, as are many other hormones. But the fact that we start to lose estrogen through perimenopause and then into menopause means that we need to look for that extra stimulus. And that extra stimulus comes from focusing on increasing our activity through strength training and increasing our intake of protein sources in our diet.
And while hormone therapy is one tool in the toolbox to keep your muscles strong and to continue to allow them to build, there are other ways to accomplish that. And on the flip side, hormone therapy alone isn't going to do it. You know, you can't just take your hormone therapy and expect to be fit and strong. But I want to circle back to something that you said, because you mentioned about how when you first started this journey, that you were well aware, of course, that there are changes that occur just as a consequence of aging. And I think, you know, that's not a surprise that that's the case. A lot of things happen as we age. But one of the shifts in terms of why there's this interest in menopause and muscle strength and muscle health is the realization that it's not just aging. You know, we all age, but women take this nosedive that men do not take when they get to be about 50 in terms of muscle strength and aches and pains and all of those things. And I'm sure you saw that study that came out very recently that looked at women who went through premature menopause, premature ovarian failure. So they were under the age of 40, and that they had profound changes in terms of their muscle health and strength, which was, you know, kind of proof positive that, hey, folks, this isn't just about aging, that you take away someone's estrogen, even if they're young, and that's going to not be good for their muscles. So what was your response to that article? Did you like stand up and cheer, or did you, you know, what was?
I like anything that recognizes that there are profound shifts in a woman's body and there's things we can do about it, right? And there was another one as well that showed that post-menopause women with low levels of estrogen were still able to build and maintain muscle. And yes. So I think what I take from all of these studies is that it's really great to acknowledge that these shifts happen. When you're talking about someone in premature menopause or, you know, early menopause, they're also going to have a high risk of osteoporosis, as you will probably right. have spoken about as well. And so you typically can't plan for that event happening because you don't usually know you're going to go into early menopause, right? But one of the recommendations that is given to women in that state is that they've got to start strength training straight away, as well as the medical interventions from the doctors like yourself. which is typically hormone therapy, they have to start doing everything they can to preserve bone and to preserve muscle and even build muscle. It's sort of one of the best investments you can make in your body moving forward. And then for women who are going into perimenopause, just in that natural phase, as difficult as it can be, I just think that knowing that this is one of the best things you can do for your body to improve your life quality as you go through to postmenopause and for the rest of your life, it's a really important conversation to be having. But the interplay between estrogen, muscles, and bone has to be spoken about, because I don't think we really even appreciated it so much in the general population conversation.
And that's why that study was so important. But in a perfect world, every woman, when she goes through menopause, whether it's premature, early menopause, or just at the normal time, that someone would have that discussion about how important it is to maintain not just bone mass, but muscle mass as well by doing strength training. But let's be honest here. This is not happening 99% of the time. It's all these women who are saying, great, thanks a lot. I'm now post-menopause, 10 years. Is it all over for me? And I think the message, and I'm hoping your message is, no, things you can't reverse. But if vaginal dryness, I don't care if you're 50, 60, 70, 80, or 90 years old, we can get it back. We can restore lubrication. We can restore elasticity. We can make it so that you have a functional vagina. Can the same be said of muscles, Amanda?
Well, it's really great that you said that, because we know there are some things that are progressive through menopause, and it's really great to raise awareness about it, like the genitourinary symptoms, right? I mean, yesterday I had a UTI and I was like, oh my God, it's the second one I've had in my life, and I'm 5 years post-menopause, and I know it's because I haven't been on top of my protocol, which is the intra-rosa and a little bit of vaginal estrogen.
It's a reminder. You got to do this all the time, every day until you die. You know, that's...
Yeah. And if we know that, that's okay. It's like flossing your teeth. You just get into a system of doing it. But we don't think about that when we think about exercise. We often think about exercise as something we have to do, or maybe or you've got these ideas of the past of exercise was like punishment or a way to burn up the extra calories you had. There's definitely been a shift in that conversation, thankfully. And one of the things that I think is really important to know is that even in your 60s, 70s, and 80s, you can still build muscle. That was that study that came out 2 weeks ago that said that. There's a great example of this. Train like Joan. She's called Joan McDonald. She's in her 70s and she had metabolic syndrome. She had multiple things going on and she's reversed all of those. She's fit, she's strong, she's healthy. And she started strength training and she's changed her diet. She's an inspiration to millions because she's got millions of followers to say that you're not done for just because you're getting older. Yeah. I think as well, the way that we talk about exercise has definitely shifted. I mean, when women think of exercise, they think of cardio, right? Because that's what we've all done. We come from the Jane Fonda age. We've done aerobics with Kathy Smith. We've done all of those things, but there was never an emphasis on strength training. And the strength training was for the bros in the gym, right? That was for like the sweaty guys that grunted and we never crossed, right? But what we do know from the studies, you said 99% of the time it's not happening. You're not actually too far from the truth.
What's the actual statistic?
The actual statistics are for the recommended movement recommendations from the government. It's 150 minutes of moderate activity a week, and that's cardiovascular activity, or 75 minutes a week of really vigorous exercise, like anaerobic without exercise. So between 10 and 20 minutes a day, only 85% of the population are not meeting that recommendation. And when it comes to strength training, the number that aren't doing that is way, way higher.
Yeah.
So most people aren't even meeting the basic recommendations for moving every day.
No, I know. And, I do the news in Chicago. I'm a health correspondent for a Chicago TV station. And so last week on the news, I talked about a study that came out looking at people who are just not able to meet that requirement that you spoke about, and the what they studied in this particular protocol was, well, is it just as good if somebody walks enough, you know, if they do 7,000 steps a day? And what they found is that as far as cardiovascular health, which is answering a different question, but it was just interesting that from a cardiovascular health point of view, that even if you're not an exerciser, if you don't do this moderate or more intense exercise, that you can make up for it if you are active enough in your day-to-day activities. And I think that's also a piece of this. You mentioned you floss your teeth every day. You brush your teeth every day. How do we work strength training? How do we work our muscle strength into our daily routines? Part of it is just kind of thinking creatively. How can I make it part of my routine? So I'm not thinking about, oh, I should exercise. It's automatic. When I brush my teeth, I do my squats. My husband laughs at me. He just thinks, I look, he's like, oh my God, you're at it again. He walks in the bathroom and there I am squatting and brushing my teeth. It works for me. What can I say?
I always say strong thighs save lives, and they do.
Know that study that they say that one of the biggest predictors of if you're going to live another 6 months is if you're sitting on a chair, and if you're not able to rise from that chair without using your hands, that is a huge predictor of frailty. And frailty, of course, is associated with having to go to a nursing home and not being able to do for yourself, but also in terms of mortality. So
it's falling and not getting up again.
Serious business. Yeah. It's serious business. We know that starting about the time of menopause, that women lose roughly 1-2% of their muscle mass a year. You know, like we're looking at about 10% a decade, which obviously adds up.
And just going to what it looks like being sedentary from the age of about 30 onwards, about 3-8% per decade, so less than 1% a year, is how we start to lose our lean body mass, right? That's accelerated through menopause, you said, to about 1% per decade. And then it sort of levels out a little bit, as does bone health in that 10 years after menopause that we see. So it's the shift through menopause that's the big wham bam that hits us, right? So if we know from the age of 30 that we're already going to start like seeing a declining at our muscle mass, it means we need to do the 5 push-ups when we have our cup of coffee in the morning against the countertop, because showing up every day and doing those small things is really going to improve our health.
So if someone's basically doing nothing, the idea of doing any kind of training, but particularly strength training, can be kind of overwhelming. So how does someone get started with the Amanda Thieb program? I mean, are they better off doing a little something every day, or maybe hiring a personal trainer and committing to spending all Saturday morning at the gym?
We have studies to show that consistency, even in small amounts, is way more beneficial than not doing anything for weeks and weeks and then doing a workout and thinking, oh, I've made up for time. I call what you do exercise snacking, and I love it. So find those little moments in the day when you can do 5 push-ups against the kitchen countertop, or 10 squats, 15 squats as you brush your teeth, even though I got motion sickness thinking of that. And with regard to just moving more, being sedentary is one of the biggest problems we've got for our health. And so just the movement, and not even talking about exercise, just moving more. If you sit at your desk every day and you don't get up, every hour, get up and walk around, you know, go and see a friend somewhere else and come back to your desk. Like, just move more. And that is called a non-exercise activity thermogenesis. And in our world, we know the acronym is NEAT. And NEAT just essentially means any movement that you do outside of planned exercise. So that's your squats. That's you're doing your isometric holds, and that's your planks and your calf raises, right? And that's getting off the bus an extra stop just to walk into work. It's just moving more throughout the day. It's not planned exercise. And
I love the concept of snacking. Can I borrow that phrase?
I'm pretty sure I didn't make it up, but I.
You know, when I do that, when I'm making my cup of coffee in the morning and I put my little capsule in, and, you know, what does that take? 45 seconds or something, instead of just standing there and staring at the coffee. I do. I put my hands on the counter and I do push-ups. I know it sounds silly, but I'm glad to hear that you think that that's not stupid.
I did a post the other day. I did myself a challenge, which isn't for anyone else. My New Year's resolution was 50 push-ups a day for the year. And people are like, oh, that's so many. But I'll do like 5 in the morning when I'm making my coffee. I'll do them against the kitchen counter. I might do full push-ups. I might do them against the wall. I don't care. It's my challenge. I made it up. But it's not the process of doing the push-ups. It's the process of showing up, giving myself a tick in the box and actually being accountable. Because when you start doing something regularly, it then just becomes that habit, and it's habits that change your health over anything else. Positive habits moving forward, and they can be teeny tiny, like exercise, snacking.
This isn't just about looking buff and being able to fit into our size 6 jeans. This is about not only quality of life, but length of life. So can you talk a little bit about the long-term impact of the loss of muscle mass?
Yes, definitely. It's because strength training changes us on a cellular level. It doesn't just change our muscles. It can improve our heart health, our joint health, our ligaments, and our tendons.
Cognitive function. The data is very, very clear. The scientific data shows that if you are looking at risk factors for dementia, being sedentary is one of them. And exercise throughout life has an enormous impact.
It does. And there's also studies on specifically strength training. We already know that about cardiovascular training. So for anyone listening, that'd be like you're running, you're swimming, you're walking. Strength training in particular as well has a huge impact on the brain. And what they're now showing is that it's recommended in government guidelines, 2 sessions a week. It's a recommended guidelines for strength training. And it's now also used in the protocol for depression and anxiety treatment, along with pharmaceuticals and therapy, et cetera. So we're seeing a ton of data coming out. And the last one is improved longevity, right? Because of all of the things that you've just said, improved longevity when you're frail and you can't get up off your seat, when you fall and you can't get up and you break your bones. All of those things actually shorten our lifespan, and we want to be able to sort of live that second part of our lives with real good quality, and being active is the way to sort of like reach those goals.
And the other thing also I think is worth mentioning is balance, because so often when we see people that have osteoporosis and they're at risk for fracture, they don't break the bone until they fall down. And why do they fall down? Because they don't have the muscle strength, they don't have the balance, their posture has changed. So there's that aspect of making sure that we have healthy muscles as we age too. Okay, we've spent probably enough time on exercise, even though we could go on with that for a long time. And I do want to get to hormones. But before that, let's talk about diet, because diet is important. And I'm not just talking about maintaining a healthy weight. And again, we're not just talking about how we want to look or how we feel best. It's really about in terms of how are we best going to promote healthy muscles? What kinds of things need to be part of someone's diet?
So nutritional science as well is pretty grounded, and we understand what happens to the body from a physiological standpoint when we consume food. Even though there are a ton of fad diets out there, Lauren, I think that most people just understanding some basic nutritional science could take that a long way. What I find that happens in menopause is that our body goes through a pretty seismic shift in so many ways. And physically, that sort of, we see at this, like, we become shapeshifters, you know, we start to hold more weight around our belly, you know, just because of our fat deposit changes from the hormonal profile changes. And it can be a real, real shock for women. And so they just want to fix that quickly. And I'm a real fan of not doing that. I'm a real fan of saying, let's just take a pause and look at what your diet looks like, right? What changes in menopause that you really need to take care of? We also need to know that when estrogen and progesterone start to decline, which you obviously know about, that it influences our hunger hormones, the ghrelin and leptin. So we stop to having that natural regulation on food consumption.
Oh, and a lot and sleep. I mean, sleep, of course, is really going to mess with your hunger
with
hormones.
Exactly. So
which
stress,
is why, you know, secondarily
sleep.
To hot flashes and insomnia and everything that goes along with perimenopause.
But they're all intertwined, right? They're all together. So when you know you're permanently hungry and you're never satisfied because of ghrelin and leptin, and you're not sleeping, and so your cravings increase as well, the chances are your body's going to change even more shape-wise. What we do know, though, there are some specific things that you need to look for in changing your diet. And I'm all about what can you add, Lauren, instead of what can you restrict? Because the minute we restrict, we
crave it.
Don't
eat French fries ever. I'm only going to think about French fries.
And then what you're going to do, you're going to order the extra large and you're going to stick gravy and cheese on. You've got poutine and then there's no stopping you. So, but it's that, it's exactly that. We just rebound and it's this diet cycle we want to try and avoid. So we already spoke about protein. Our protein requirements increase through menopause. They increase as you get older. All older people should be eating more protein. It's why they drink those ensure drinks, I think, because they just can't eat as much.
Flashback to medical school and residency, walking into patients' rooms, holding a can of Ensure, saying, you must drink this. I don't think I could ever drink one, Amanda. Not ever. I just don't.
I know. But what's happened is protein sources have become more widely available now, even for those that are plant-based. And so there's lots of different ways you can get extra protein in your diet. How much should you be looking for? Well, it definitely is based on your size, your activity level, and all of those different things. But as a rule of thumb, I like to say to women, try and get 100 grams of protein a day. That's sort of a good rule of thumb. So if you're eating four times a day, most of us eat three or four times a day, that's 25 grams every meal. I always try and look for 30 just to cover my bases. And what does that look like? Well, that could be a protein shake because a scoop of protein powder has 25 grams in. A Greek yogurt has 25 grams in, a cup of Greek yogurt, a small 4-ounce breast of chicken or steak or a piece of salmon. They all have about 25 grams, 30 grams of protein in. And so if you look for something like that at every meal, and oh my God, protein bars now are so, so delicious. Like they literally taste like candy. And so maybe you have one of those as well. 20 grams of protein for 200 calories is a pretty good investment in your protein intake for the day.
Right. And it's going to make a difference because I think people think in terms of, okay, I'm going to have some protein so that I'll feel full and won't eat the bad stuff. And that's fine. But it goes beyond that because you need the protein to build your muscles and to make sure that you don't lose your strength.
And then fiber. And then the only other thing I was going to say is women, generally people don't eat enough fiber. So trying to get at least 25 grams of fiber in a day. So it'd be very plant heavy, look for your protein. And that's a really good place to start.
Fiber, so people will actually poop, or fiber because that's going to help their muscles, or both?
It's going to definitely help their cholesterol level as well, right? So like there's a ton of benefits to having fiber, but I always just think, firstly, we need to go to the bathroom. So it's really good for that,
All right, so let's talk for a minute about Ozempic and the other GLP-1 inhibitors, because they're out there. A lot of people are using them, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but there has been a lot of concern about the impact on muscle mass as people are losing weight. Do you have any thoughts about that? Anything you'd like to say?
Well, we can talk about it, but really, you're going to be the expert, not me, when it comes to Ozempic. And I definitely come from this from a layman standpoint because this isn't my area of expertise. But what I do know after speaking to a really good friend of mine, Dr. Spencer Nadolsky, who is an obesity medicine doctor who regularly uses Ozempic, he has looked at some of the data that's coming out. Well, he's looked at most of the data that's come out, and it's reassuring. And I think it seems to be a really great tool for a lot of people in the obese category that really do need help. I mean, obviously for diabetes, that's a different conversation, but when you're using it for weight loss, it looks like it's one of those really helpful tools because it works with the hunger hormones and the food noise. What does it mean about losing muscle mass? That's a really interesting question. When anybody loses weight, anybody, whether they're on Ozempic or not, they will lose both fat, water, and muscle. That's what they're going to lose. When you lose a lot of weight quickly, you're going to still lose fat, water, and muscle. And so the question is how, when you're losing weight rapidly, which is what tends to happen when you're using something like a semaglutide or Ozempic, you need to make sure that you're strength training at the same time. And any doctor worth their salt who is giving out these medications should be also promoting the lifestyle interventions that are absolutely necessary and critical, you know, if you're losing a large amount of weight quickly. Yeah. That's the message moving forward.
Yeah, the message is you don't just use your GLP-1 inhibitor, your semaglutide, whatever, that you need to also make some changes in terms of activity, strength training, and all of that. You know, I'm not big on supplements in general. I think that you can get what you need from food. And we all know that there are a lot of supplements out there that are being advertised because, let's face it, there's a lot of money to be made in supplements. And people have this idea that, yeah, it all follow the money. But having said that, are there any supplements that you think are legitimate as opposed to being just something that you could flush down your toilet? And the one specifically I'd like to ask you about, and then we can talk about any others you think are important, is creatine. Because that's the one that I keep hearing about as having some real science behind it in terms of helping with building muscle and having endurance.
Yeah, so I'm like you, Lauren. I actually don't take any supplements. I just don't like taking them, truthfully. That's why I don't. I take vitamin D in the winter because I struggle with seasonal affective disorder pretty badly, and I can't afford to live in the Caribbean year round. So
you and me both, yeah.
But creatine is one of the really well-studied sports supplements that you can probably take. And so the two supplements that I take that I don't particularly count as supplements because I just feel like they're just part of my regimen now are whey protein isolate, so protein supplement, and creatine. I particularly like the whey isolate. It's the purest form of the cow, of the dairy.
It's W-H-E-Y whey?
Correct, okay. W-H-E-Y. And it contains a large amount of leucine. It's an amino acid that is very, very efficient in the body. And the body in a menopausal state really likes leucine. It also crosses blood-brain barrier. So it can sort of just be helpful for just getting into all of the systems in the body. Creatine has been studied for quite a long time, and the person that everyone should be following is Dr. Darren Kandau. What the studies are showing is that creatine taken on a daily basis, and it's a very small amount, can build up in the system and can help with muscular performance and endurance, right? But it doesn't particularly help with strength. What it does is it just helps you your performance just be more efficient and last longer. It's not like a steroid though. Like it's just literally another component that we find in food, but taken as a supplement can help with that. But I don't think it's super significant. I think it's helpful, but you're not just going to start taking it and go, oh my God, I can now lift 500 pounds instead of 300 pounds. It doesn't quite work like that.
Also a difference between a competitive athlete and someone who's a snacker or a recreational athlete.
I don't think they would really need it, truthfully. And I often question whether I really need it. And I sort of am self-experimenting on myself. I work out 5 days a week in the gym, right? So I feel like I'm a good person to test it. That's not what the average bear is doing. I know. I appreciate that. There's also some data to show that creatine can potentially help with cognitive health in older adults, not younger. I'm thinking in their 60s and older. I don't know how significant that is. And I think those research studies are continuing. So it's one of those ones that has been shown to have basically no downside apart from a little bit of bloating, apparently, and many upsides. But how big those upsides are, to me, I think you've just got to try it for yourself. There's lots of people try it and then just stop taking it because they think it's not worth it.
Yeah.
But it's not particularly expensive. And I definitely think that if you are somebody who is serious about strength training in particular, it's definitely worth a consideration.
Yeah, that's the message I've heard from other people that I trust as well. And the majority of those other supplements that are out there, it's like, oh my God, do not waste your money. Do not waste your money. It's just
And there's also the concern that a lot of supplements, because they're not regulated, don't contain what they say they're going to contain,
and maybe correct. Have you don't cross, know what you're getting. I mean, I've done
cross contamination.
It's really frightening. It's really terrible. All right, so let's move on to hormone therapy because we want to get there, and I want to talk both a little bit about estrogen and then testosterone, which we don't talk about as often. So quickly, estrogen, and we've already established that there's lots of estrogen receptors on muscle, and that while women can strengthen and build muscle based on everything you've just talked about, but a little estrogen is not a bad idea either, right?
But I don't know that there's compelling studies that say taking estrogen will build muscle. That's the thing, right? So I think that when we have this conversation, we have to have it in a complete topic. Yeah. So what I think and what I sort of felt for myself is that a lot of women don't do strength training or exercise very much during perimenopause because they literally can't, because they're stuck in their tracks, because they're so symptomatic, because they've got chronic fatigue. Just life is just too hard and it's just an extra thing to do. And then hormone therapy is one of those interventions that can make them feel normal again, make them feel like they can take on new things, that they can potentially start exercising again. And so I think that that's the role that estrogen therapy plays in the exercise conversation, because I haven't seen any studies, and I'm happy to like talk to you and you can prove me wrong and all of those things, because it's so interesting to me that say women on hormone therapy fare better in a strength training environment than those that aren't on it, because that's not the main stimulus that's needed to build
and I totally agree in that this is not the cure-all. But there are a couple of studies that are interesting. One was a study that came out about 3 or 4 months ago that specifically looked at women on hormone therapy versus women who had not been on hormone therapy in terms of frailty specifically, you know, looking at frailty, looking at muscle strength, and how many women ended up in a nursing home as a result of frailty. And there was a huge difference between the estrogen group and the non-estrogen group. The other study that I'm sure you didn't see because it came out literally like 2 days ago, it's in this month's journal, Menopause, looked at women who were on hormone therapy versus women who were not on hormone therapy. And then they looked at what happened with their muscles, and they did biopsies. And what was really interesting about this study is they looked 8 years after the women had stopped hormone therapy. You know, the point being, did you see this study of anything?
No, it just came out.
It just came out. Yeah. So what was interesting is they're saying, okay, there is a difference between the estrogen group and the non-estrogen group in terms of strength of muscles, what we're actually seeing in muscle biopsies. But the question is, what happens when you go off hormone therapy? Because we know that when it comes to bone health, women who are on estrogen are going to prevent the progression from osteopenia to osteoporosis. It's not going to build bone, but it's going to stabilize the bone. But the minute they go off their estrogen,
they lose that
benefit. It goes away. So the purpose of this study was to say, is the same true of muscles? If you take women off of their estrogen, what's going to happen to their muscles 8 years later? So they did biopsies 8 years later of women who had been on estrogen and women who had never been on estrogen. And what they found is that it wasn't dramatic. You know, the women who had been on estrogen, that their muscle biopsies were a little bit better in terms of, you know, the different parameters they looked at for strength and all that. But what they did find that was significantly different, and I'm trying to remember the exact wording because I just quickly read this article yesterday for a journal club I was doing, that the women who'd been on estrogen, that they tended to be more active even after they went off the estrogen, you know, that they had maintained this more of the vigor, the activity, and that was one of the significant differences. So not a definitive study,
but it was an interesting study.
Yeah. It was an interesting study. And the fact that they were able to still see some changes in the muscles. So I think Listen, I mean, it would be surprising if there weren't
watch
changes
this space.
because there's hormone receptors. And speaking of hormone receptors, let's talk about testosterone, because as everyone has heard me say a gazillion times, testosterone is not a male hormone. It's a human hormone. And it's just as important for women as for men. And one of the things that was interesting is that study that we talked about earlier on, the women who went through premature menopause and what happened to them in terms of their muscle strength, et cetera. And in that particular study, and I don't know if you remember this particular nuance, but they divided the premature menopause group into two groups, women that spontaneously went into a premature menopause before the age of 40, and women that had a surgical menopause, that they had ovary removal when they were in their 30s, which instantly put them postmenopause. And they did far worse. I mean, if you compared the spontaneous early menopause, which already had problems, and then you looked at the surgical menopause, it was much worse. And why? Because the premise is, not exactly proven, but the premise is that when you have someone who goes through menopause but still has their ovaries, those ovaries are going to continue to make testosterone. The levels are going to decline, but they're still going to make some testosterone. And of course, we make some in our adrenal glands as well. But the women who had ovary removal, they had a sudden drop, not just in their estrogen, but in their testosterone.
Testosterone, that makes a ton of sense.
It makes total sense. But I think what that also does is it highlights the point that we also need testosterone to maintain peak muscle strength and peak muscle health, right? So what's your message on that?
Well, one of the things that's really interesting to me is that, first of all, the frailty study that you talked about, I always think that, like, there's got to be more to the conversation. Were these people doing any exercise? Were they sedentary? Because, you know, there's always a bigger conversation.
Absolutely.
When it comes to testosterone, of course, it's in our bodies, in the female body, and it's required for our muscle health. But when we start to lose that testosterone and estrogen, does it mean that we can't build muscle? The answer is we can still build muscle. So I don't fully understand this, but there's got to be other mechanisms that go into place that allow us to do that. Usually it's part of that muscle protein synthesis stimulus. But when we lose estrogen and we lose testosterone, it doesn't mean that we can't continue to build. To me, it's like that even if you're on hormone therapy or not, the levels are so low that you're giving women, it's not having a huge impact. And especially testosterone, the levels of the female psychological doses that you give are so low, they don't have a massive impact on the muscle growth. I mean, we're not talking about anabolic levels unless you're taking maybe pellets. Right.
And I think, but just to stop you for a minute there, I think when we talk about testosterone supplementation, it's really, really important to differentiate between testosterone supplementation that is restoring physiologic levels, normal testosterone levels in a woman, as opposed to super physiologic, like you're going to see in pellets or you're going to see with athletes who are taking these anabolic steroids. We're not talking about that. You know, we're talking about, or I'm talking about using physiologic supplementation. But okay, so I think, so this is really important though, because I think the message is somewhat confusing, because on one hand, we're saying that there are these all important testosterone receptors in the muscle that are going to help in terms of strength and in terms of muscle health. And we're saying, but when we lose our testosterone, that we can make up for that in strength training and eating protein and all the things that we've already talked about. Is there a place for testosterone supplementation in terms of avoiding frailty, avoiding weakness, avoiding sarcopenia, which is the medical term for losing muscle mass? And the answer to that question is, we don't know. It's never been studied. A lot of people recommend it. A lot of people say, oh, you need to take testosterone so that you don't lose muscle mass. When in fact, to your point, that has never been proven. It's all anecdotal. And when you look at the people who are using testosterone, quite frankly, those are usually the same people who are out there exercising and, you know, making sure they get their protein in and all that kind of stuff. So That study hasn't been done.
I think you've hit on a nail on the head. Well, first of all, the studies I've been following about testosterone, and I was sort of alluding to the fact we can't definitively say this yet because we don't know. But Dr. Susan Davis in Australia from the Australasian Menopause Society is running one of the biggest research studies on testosterone in the female menopausal body. And maybe it will come up with some more answers. But at the moment, we don't know. But we do know that you can still build muscle. So there's obviously something else that's allowing that to happen. But the women that are usually exercising more, eating more protein, maybe the ones that are in a bit more of a privileged situation, because when we talk about our menopausal health, we can't not talk about the social determinants of health. And we know that poverty level, income status, all of those things make a huge difference. And the ones that can afford the private testosterone are the ones that can usually afford it as well. Exactly. They've probably got the gym memberships and all those things.
It's an entire lifestyle thing. But the other thing also, and just to kind of again play devil's advocate here, you and I are both out there on social media, there are a lot of people in the menopause space who are really pushing this whole testosterone conversation. And when you say, okay, but we don't have the data, the response is, we don't have time to wait for the data. You know, women are wasting away. And if we wait for Susan Davies' data and some of these other people that are really studying it, that's going to take easily 7-10 years or more until we find out what is the long-term impact of taking testosterone versus not taking testosterone. What is going to be the recommendation 10 or 15 years from now? Their response is, we can't wait for science. You know, I've always been talking about how I'm into evidence-based science, and you can't just recommend things without having the studies. But I'm starting to get a lot of pushback from people saying, yeah, that's fine in your ivory academic tower, but meanwhile, I don't want to wait for these studies. So what's your take on that? Because you see you're out there on social media.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I see it too. And my take's very similar to yours. I mean, I have a huge respect for the menopause societies and the medical consensus, because I know they don't just arbitrarily say things. There is a team of researchers that put out the best evidence as we know it. And I also think we have to look at your own personal risk profile. If women are talked about with their doctors about hormones, and they understand the potential issues and side effects and long-term issues, if they may be there, that's up between them and their doctor. That's a risk that they're prepared to take. I have a I'm very risk averse, and I personally think that that's experimenting, and I don't want to be someone that's experimented on. I'd much rather know that I was taking something that was known to be safe and effective for the thing that it's prescribed for. Most things that we take have like benefits outside of what they're prescribed for. Like hormone therapy isn't prescribed for very much. It's vasomotor symptoms, osteoporosis if you're early menopause, and GSM, right? Pretty much, but we know it can help with sleep. It can help with energy. It can help with mood.
Yeah, I mean, the example I always give is you look at local vaginal estrogen, which is only FDA approved for vaginal dryness and painful sex, when in fact, we know that it also is going to help with recurrent urinary tract infections and urgency. And that's all really important. So yeah, it's not about that we're saying you can't use things off label is the correct terminology. Of course, you can use them off label, but we want the science behind it. You know, what this is there's a group of menopause experts that get together once a week and do the deep dive into all of these new articles that come out and all the science.
And what was the consensus from that? What was the
consensus was, we don't have the data, but is it okay to do it on an individual basis? Yes. You have to look at the person. You have to look at what they're trying to accomplish, what their risk factors are, what other benefits there might be. And certainly once you let the woman know that we don't really have the data, you know, again, the theme of shared decision making, we don't really have the data. There may be benefits. These are the pros. These are the cons. And if you would like to take some testosterone for something other than libido, which is what we have the most data on, then perhaps it might help you in terms of muscle strength and frailty down the road. But we don't know. But the group that is in this particular journal club, for the most part, we're talking the academics. You know, these are the people who are writing the journal articles, the people who are part of the Menopause Society. These are not the people who are out there in social media saying everyone should take testosterone. So,
and one of my biggest problems, it's the other world. Yeah. And that's the world I personally trust. I have a big distrust of social media because I'm on it and I see what happens. And one of the biggest problems I have is that when these social media doctors make blanket statements.
Right.
And I think that that's really unfair to women. Right. And that's
Everyone should do that. And that's
why aren't all women on testosterone? Why aren't all women on estrogen to prevent Alzheimer's and things like that? And I'm like, well, because we can't say that yet.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be great?
That's so funny because it was the other topic last night too. There was a new article that came out about the use of estrogen for prevention of dementia and Alzheimer's. And there was a very interesting discussion about that, which is a whole nother topic.
Yeah. But I also think that, you know, I think that if you're an expert on social media, that you do have a sense of responsibility to say, well, it may be, and we need more data and we should look at this instead of having blanket statements, because I just think that that's disingenuous. And I think that women deserve better.
Inappropriate. It's dangerous. And if anybody looks at my comments on social media, when I do get questions, first of all, I don't like, quite frankly, answering questions on social media because I'm not that person's doctor and it's a little bit dicey and I'm very careful. But if you look at my answers, how I word them, it's never, ever, ever, I recommend you should do this. It's always like someone on social media this morning said something about, I'm getting red dots from my patch and it's coming off and what should I do? And instead of me saying, this is what I think you should do, I said, well, it's hard to say, but for a lot of women, this is sometimes what's going on. So you really need to see whoever prescribed the patch to see if that's what's going on with you, which is a very different message than saying, oh my God, it's absolutely obvious. And if you would just eat more cream cheese, then that wouldn't happen. You know, I don't do that. I don't, because it's just inappropriate.
And it's also just to finish that one off, it's not just the doctors that do this. It's like, I have a community group and women are like, you should just increase your hormone therapy dose. You should just do this. And I'm like, it's the worst.
All right. Before we finish up here. So two things. One, I meant to mention earlier, but I forgot. You're not from here. You're not from around here. No, but I think it's worth mentioning because you talked about guidelines and things and you are Canadian. That's not where you're originally from, but you are. You are Canadian. And when we talk about those guidelines, many of them are very similar to US guidelines, but they are not always exactly the same. So I think that's worth noting. And the other thing I want to ask you before we close is anything you want to talk about? What are you doing? What do you want everyone to know? What's going on in your world?
What's going on? So I was just mentioning to you before we recorded, I'm one of the co-founders of a company called Naya Health, who are based in Canada. And we're looking to do full assessments for menopausal women via telemedicine. And what we're doing is we're modeling the national menopause clinics because we have a socialized healthcare here. But there's currently a two-year wait list to go to those. And there's only three in Canada and it's the second biggest country in the world.
Only three. Wow.
Yeah. But when you get into them, it's amazing because you get this, a full intake risk assessment. You see a professional for an hour and then you get obviously recommendations afterwards. And so we're going through the process of doing that at the moment. It's a lot of work, but we're hoping to give a really valid option to women who literally cannot get to see a doctor. So that's what I'm working on at the moment.
This is covered by Canadian healthcare. This is not a service that people pay for, correct?
This would be a service that people pay for, and here's why. So there are no billing codes for menopause in Canada, none. And so doctors who are even in part of the menopause clinics have to finagle codes together and put them through just to be able to see women. And it can only be doctors. Any other healthcare professionals like pharmacists or nurse practitioners who can prescribe and assess as well as long as they're trained, have no way of doing billing codes, they have to be paid a salary. It's crazy. But what we are doing is working with our insurance companies, because we also have health benefits here in Canada, to be able to, because this is a healthcare professional that's doing this, so should be able to go through insurances. So it's the system in Canada is currently not working well. It's broken, and we have to reimagine how healthcare looks. We've got no other choice.
I would say the same for US, but it sounds like when it comes to menopause, we're even a little bit more broken than we are, and things.
It's not great. It's not great. Yeah.
And by the way, according to my analytics, 15% yes. of my listeners are from Canada. So maybe I'll even
call that's awesome.
Now that I get you as a guest.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously I'm English. I'm not Canadian. And so you might get some more British people following you.
I'm 2% right now in the UK. So that would be.
I just wanted to sort of end by saying, do you remember how we met? We met at an event in New York. You came in as a speaker, and it was like a think tank for a new pharmaceutical that was potentially going to happen. And I met you then, and I was like, oh my God, I love the way she talks. You're just a no-nonsense, no BS doctor. And I loved it. And then I found your video of you taking on Oprah and Suzanne Summers about the compounded. And I just was like, she's like, not all heroes wear capes, Lauren. It was such a great moment.
That's so funny. I did not remember that at all. So how fun is that? How those little chance encounters turn into nice relationships years later.
Yeah.
And I have to say, not only do I love the way you talk, but I just changed my Siri in my car, who gives me directions, to have a British accent, because she sounds not only more credible, but so much more
polite. Will you please turn right?
So lovely. I love your accent. So thank you for all that you do. And thank you for spending this time. I've learned a lot. And we have
me too. And I think we just keep an open mind about a lot of these things. Keep learning. Never say never. I think we're moving forward, and we're making strides in this conversation. And I think these type of interactions are super important for us all.
Thank you. Thank you for all that you do. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, and thank you for joining me. You will find lots more information in my Insight Information books, available on Amazon.com. And follow Francie as she navigates her way through vaginal dryness, hot flashes, and pretty much every menopausal symptom you can think of.
See the light. Now I'm sleeping through the night. I fall.